Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Michael Newton Brown, a man of many talents, who is currently using his talent as a director to direct a production of the musical Dear World, a not often seen but really interesting musical currently playing at the Players Theater in Sarasota, Florida. Listen to how a man who comes from a family that doesn't know from theater becomes someone who does everything in theater. And hear how in the pursuit of learning everything there is to know about theater, Michael's life gets tangled up with Bette Midler and Barry Manilow. Stay tuned. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about recognizing the fact that you, like the rest of us, probably came out of childhood in denial for some parts of yourself, some ways in which you behave, some things you think, some skills you have, some things that are natural to you, which for some reason you needed to pretend were not so. And you got so good at the pretense that you forgot. And so you no longer remember that you are able to be angry or silly or smart or, unfortunately, in some cases, healthy. So I'm here to tell you that there is a very good chance that there are things about you that you don't know. And those things may be the very things that you need to live the life that is the best life you can live. As a psychotherapist, people quite often come in to see me and they say, you know, I can't confront. People are taking advantage of me right and left. My boss is not is wiping the floor with me, and I can't tell him that I've been here for 5 years and I deserve a raise. I can't tell my wife, my husband, my sister, my mother to stop saying these things to me, which are embarrassing and insulting. I can't. inevitably, we discover that this person actually has the capacity to confront, to stand up for him or herself, to be an advocate for themselves. But they learned as a child that standing up for themselves was either going to get them punished, embarrassed, teased, ignored, even abused. And so they learn to hide this ability deep inside and then to forget that they had it. So often the things that people come into therapy to get, they already have. So the Lynn Show is an attempt to remind you that there may be things that you have forgotten. And they may be things that you need today. And they may be already there. So, part of the way that I make this point, well, part of the way that I have made this point in the past, aside from being available for therapy, is in the book I wrote, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want and What to Do About It. You can get information about the book. You can listen to the first chapter, I think, of the audiobook. You can find out more about me if you're interested at my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow, thelynshow.com. And you can also hear all the interviews that I've done, and that's the other thing I do on the show. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do it because these are people who, at least in the area of their work, are exactly who they are. You can't help it, because in order to make a living or a life with an art in this culture, it has to be exactly who you are. So today I am playing an interview with Michael Newton Brown, who, as I said in the lead-in, can do just about anything that one can do in theater. Michael's story is interesting because he comes from a family where his father was the track coach at school, the quintessential jock, I think Michael says of him. And still, Michael discovered very, very young that theater was his passion. And so he was able to find ways in his childhood to pursue that, and then to do everything: stage manage, scene design, circus, lighting design, and directing, which is what he is currently doing at the Players Theater in Sarasota, Florida. He is directing a production of Jerry Herman's musical, Dear World, which has not been seen very much, but which is just a gem of a musical. Michael's story is really interesting, not only because it's the story of a man who comes from a very unlikely theater background and somehow manages to use his creativity and his cleverness to pursue what he wants, even in the face of what his family seems to want him to be. But also because Michael came of age in a particular time in our history when there was a lot of turmoil, and Michael seemed to be in the middle of it, although not by choice. So Michael, it's interesting, he says his father was a history teacher, and he is a history buff, having been, as you'll hear him say, dragged to every historical site in the United States. But Michael seems actually to have witnessed and been, in an ironic way, a part of a very tumultuous time in our history. So this is a very, very interesting story. And in addition to the interestingness of this story, Michael mentions that Maureen McGovern, one of the people to have starred in Dear World, has on YouTube her singing one of the songs from the show. He talks about that in the interview, and I was lucky enough to be able to download that. So after my interview with Michael, you will hear Maureen McGovern singing one of the songs from Dear World, and it is my hope that it will stimulate your curiosity and that you will run right down to the Players Theater. And if you don't live nearby, that you'll come and visit us in Sarasota. And while you're here, you'll go see Dear World. But now, here, Michael Newton Brown. So I am here, finally, with Michael Newton Brown, who is about to direct Dear World for the Players Theater. Correct?
Right.
Okay, I got that right. All right, so I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. And that does describe you, does it not?
Pretty much.
Yes, right. Good. Okay, so I always ask the same question. And actually, just before I ask it, the art that you and I are talking about right now is for theater, but that's not the only art that you have spent your life doing. Am I correct?
No, I'm a director, I'm a scenic designer, and I'm a lighting designer.
Aha.
As well.
Right. All of the things that are necessary to make the theater happen, right?
All the things that are necessary to keep you working in the business in one form or another.
Very nice. Very clever. Okay. So the question I ask is, how did it happen? Not how did you get your first job, but when, at the very beginning, did it occur to you that that theater was interesting, that designing was interesting, that color or story or... Do you remember?
My dad tells me that he took me to the senior class play. He was a teacher. And I was just a little kid and not even in elementary school yet. And they did Ten Little Indians. And he said, I spoke of nothing for 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah. Now, see, I don't remember that.
No.
But that's what he told me. And then my family, again, we traveled in the summer, and we would go to New York. And I remember my first Broadway musical was Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees, and I was 7 years old.
Uh-huh.
And all I can remember is the front curtain was all baseballs.
Uh-huh.
And I knew then, I fell in love with New York City. I said, this is where I belong.
At seven.
Yeah.
Right, right.
My first professional show was in Summer Stock at 12.
I was going to say, no, don't get ahead, but you didn't get ahead. So how did you get from seven to a first professional show at 12?
Well,
did you say to your parents, this is what I want, I have to have lessons?
I just knew. And we had the old Flat Rock. We had a summer place in North Carolina, Hendersonville. And the Flat Rock Playhouse is up there that's been there forever, Equity Professional House. And I started taking courses in children's theater. And then they cast me as small role in one of the shows. So that was my first professional production. I was 12 years old.
Wow.
And then I went through all the drama club and everything in high school. And
So now you're an actor. Right, I mean, that's
how most everybody starts.
I know, right.
You know? But even then, I was watching the scenery, and I was watching the production.
Yes, of course. You remember the baseballs.
I remember the baseballs.
Right.
You know. Mm-hmm. And then I did drama school, in thespians in high school and all of that, and president of the drama club, and where all my friends got their sweaters with their letters in... football and whatever else. I got mine in theater. I got all my points doing it in theater. And I learned then I didn't want to be an actor because I really liked having my fingers in all those other little pies. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I like creating the product.
Okay, wait a second. Hold on. I'm interested that you said all my friends got letters in sports and I got it in theater. This is interesting to me because it suggests that you had friends across the board, that mm-hmm. you had friends who were jocks, you had friends who were whatever, but is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
My father was the track coach. My father is the ultimate jock.
Wow.
And they won all kinds of state awards and everything, and And I used to do trapeze because I almost went circus. But I had a trapeze in the backyard, and that's how I worked out, is on the trapeze. And I could do ankle catches and heel catches and back layouts, and I could do all that. But the story is, because of that, my father decided that I would be a good pole vaulter. Because I could do the trapeze stuff. Mm-hmm. So he put me out there in the field with this pole in my hand, and nobody to tell me how to do it.
Run
down, stick the pole in that box, and go over the thing and land in the sawdust. Do you know how nasty sawdust in your jock strap is?
Oh, please.
No, not doing that. This is not for me. So I was a huge disappointment.
It's a real stretch who you became coming from there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. My family was not that at all. I was raised by my grandparents on his side.
So you were an only child then, essentially?
Yeah, I was the only child of an only child of an only child.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
Yeah, go ahead.
The point I was trying to make was, on those summer trips, because my father taught history and was a historian, I was dragged to every Civil War battlefield in the United States. Every ravine, every hill, every tree. And I have a wonderful appreciation of history. I love history.
Yes.
I love museums.
Mm-hmm.
I love all of that. I love art museums. So they did instill in me.
It's ironic.
The other thing that's
ironic to me is that given who your father was and what he might have wanted you to be, that he told you that thing about your first experience in theater and how you wouldn't talk about anything else. He might not have told you that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah.
So he encouraged you in an interesting way.
He did. He said, you know.
He let you be, kind of.
He let me be.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. There was one summer he didn't. It was after that summer of stock, and I wanted to go back to that theater again that summer, and he says, no, you've experienced that. This summer, you're going to learn to play golf. God, was that a disaster. Then one summer, I took art. That was cool.
So you've got this childhood in which you essentially decide at the beginning where you want to spend your life, that you want to be in the theater somehow. And then you do the best that you can with what control you have over your own life,
mm-hmm.
to explore that in school and right, and then you take as many summers as they'll give you to, right? Okay. And then you graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens?
I went to Boston University.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, and they still have, a very, very reputable theater program. And I spent 4 years at BU.
And majoring in theater?
Director. You could major directing, designing, acting. And I went in as a director. And so the first 2 years, I was doing all kinds of production stuff. They make you do that. And I had incredible acting classes and all. And at one point I wanted to leave about going into my junior year. I wanted to leave because it was too big. It was really too big, and I felt like I wasn't getting the intimacy of a small program,
mm-hmm.
where you're like a family.
Right.
But I found out that if I left, I would lose tons of credits, and I was over school. I was really over school. And I would lose a ton of credits. So I said, I'll just stick this out. And then junior and senior year, I started getting gigs that other people were not getting. And I was asked to stage for the opera. No undergraduate was ever asked to stage manage for the opera. That was a graduate director gig. And I was getting gigs like that. And then they did a big musical every year. BU was not a musical school. It's more serious. But they did a big musical, and I was asked to stage manage the big musical. And there was some flack about that. But
from whom? Other students?
Yeah. Grad students were not pleased.
because they didn't get
to do it because, you know, they needed it for the credit.
Right.
But I didn't have anything to do with it. They just asked me to do it. And then I think the most interesting thing about the Boston University experience is it was senior year, 1970, and in the spring of 1970 was Kent State and the Vietnam War, and then Jackson State. And our school, BU is an urban campus, so it's not like, it's along streets in the city. And our school happened to be by the National Guard Armory. And people were rioting and throwing Molotov cocktails. And we woke up one morning in May, I guess it was, and we were told, go home.
Because it's too dangerous.
And, then we were told, you'll be graded on whatever you've done in this semester. There will be no exams. Go home. Go home now.
Oh, my goodness.
School is closed. And we didn't get to see everybody to say goodbye.
Oh, it was the end.
Bam. Cut off.
Oh, my God.
And a few of us were able to get together in a professor's apartment and have a little party and say goodbye.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And then we were doing a show then that was going to be going to the National College Theater Festival in Washington. A friend of mine was a stage manager. I said, get me a gig. I want to go. Mm-hmm. So we went down there and performed at the festival. However, that was during the last big peace march.
Jesus.
We were tear gassed.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we were tear gassed. And we came out of a restaurant eating and looked down the street, and here they came down the street with the cops after them, and we went right back in the door of that restaurant, and they locked the door of the restaurant.
Well, so you were right in the middle of that.
I was in the middle
of
all
that.
Even
though you were not in the middle of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You were collateral damage.
Sort of, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also one of those naked people waving at you from the reflection pond. So it was an exciting time.
It was.
It was exciting time. There.
Well, yeah. So you're out of school.
Yeah.
Bang, bang.
And I had applied to Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown College, mm-hmm. back to the circus, thinking I could meet somebody who could teach me circus. And anyway, I got accepted. And this is, again, 1970. And there were 3,000 applicants then, and they accepted 30 people. And I was one of them.
Wow.
And I went through 8 weeks of hardcore basic training, circus training, down here in Venice at the old arena, mm-hmm. and got a contract on the Red Show. And I went on the Red Show for a year.
That's what is Gunter the Gable. Red Show?
They had three shows. Well, then they had two shows, the Red Show and the Blue Show. They alternated routes. They had two shows out.
Ah.
The Red Show was with Gunter Gable Williams. Mm-hmm. And I was on the road for a year with the Red Show.
Did you like it?
No.
Ah.
No, I didn't. It was really a learning experience. I've never been so lonely in the midst of a group of people in my life.
Because you're not really a circus person?
Because it's very stratified.
Really?
Well, Ringling. Right. Was very, because Ringling is huge and very corporate. And the smaller shows are more family-oriented.
Right.
But the Bulgarians hang with the Bulgarians, the Hungarians hang with the Hungarians.
Really?
Animal people hang with animal people, aerialists with aerialists. And as a clown, you're like way towards the bottom of the social ladder, just above the showgirls.
Wow.
And not a lot of cross...
Pollination
between that. And then, you know, you had the workers as well. So I had about three good friends who were also clowns on the show. And I learned that that wasn't for me.
Wow. A lot of experiences that you had to learn what was not for you.
Oh, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the... Most of my best learning experiences has been what not to
what
do.
What not to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know. And
so, what are you now, about 22, 24, something like that?
21, 22.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the show, I went back to New York. I got my equity card. I went to New York, so I was not going to go back in that town without my union card for theater. And I met someone and fell in love. And that someone had mutual friends who had been doing hair. Mm-hmm. Hair was still a big deal then. And they had been staging it in the country, different companies, because in this country you had they didn't tour so much. They had the Boston company, the LA company, the Detroit company, and they were putting those together. And then they got the gig for Scandinavia. And they'd been in Scandinavia for about a year and a half. And they called Jimmy to come over and be a company manager. And as soon as he could, Jimmy got me over there. And I didn't know what I was going to wind up doing. I thought I was going to be doing hair. But Jesus Christ Superstar had just opened in New York and was this smash. They got the rights. And I got over there, and they had just opened a Superstar in Copenhagen. And then we were going to go join what's the equivalent of the national tour in Örebro, Sweden, which was somewhere north of the Arctic Circle.
Oh, no.
Yeah, in ice halls.
Oh, and, God.
I know. And so I wind up there. Here I am. And I'm running a light board. And the lighting designer, this will come out later, the lighting designer for that had been Jule Fisher's assistant on Broadway for the lighting design for Jesus Christ Superstar.
I was wondering what he was doing in the ice.
Yeah, as were we all. Anyway, the crew was Swedish, Norwegian, Czechoslovakian, and, well, there's another one in there, maybe German. And so the stage manager would give a setup for a cue, and then you hear it translated over the headsets, and everybody knew the word go.
That's great.
Oh, it's really funny.
That's great.
It was really funny. And so after that, lived in Europe, made a ton of money, lived in Europe waiting for these producers to get their act together for the show to go to Norway. And had a flat in London for about 6 weeks. And then we had friends in Athens, Greece, who had gone to school at Columbia, and they were married, and so we went down to Carnelis' place in Athens, which was just down the hill from the Parthenon.
So this career has helped you to see the world.
Yeah, yeah, and we stayed in the old family villa, and we were there for 6 or 8 weeks. It was so cheap. It was during Papadopoulos' regime. Very interesting. We were warned by our friends, don't talk politics to anyone. Don't talk politics to cab drivers. People disappear off the streets.
Oh, my God.
Be a dumb tourist. Yeah. And they wouldn't talk to us until we went, like, out of the city to a beach where we could sit on a hill overlooking the beach.
And see if there was anyone around.
Only then would they talk to us.
Wow.
Because they were very anti-Papadopoulos. And there were gun tourists. Manned gun tourists. But Athens was so safe.
Yes, you know. I bet it was.
Yeah, because we were, the Acropolis is just like a big hill. Mm-hmm. And we were on one side of this Plaka, which is the old Athens. And then we were over the hill in whatever this neighborhood was. And you could eat dinner, or go to the bars, whatever. And you could be coming home any hour of the day or night. And it was absolutely safe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you give and you get, right?
You give and you get, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, came back to New York after that and did a couple off-Broadway shows, stage managing a couple off-Broadway shows and some summer stock, and then I get this phone call from this guy who was the lighting guy in Sweden. He's back in the States. He's formed his own lighting design company. And his first big gig is a young lady named Bette Midler, who just had a big hit with Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Mm-hmm. And it was the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy tour. And it was out in L.A., and he couldn't do it because he got a Beach Boys gig, and would I come out and take over lighting that tour? Sure. So I went out and brought the show back to Broadway. One Night Stands. Now, that was interesting, because she had just done that famous Carson show,
yes.
First time she was on Carson, and they had tried to get her to come on, and she refused to come on unless she could bring her band and her girls and do it her way. And finally they relented. And that was the night America discovered Bette Midler.
The Divine Miss M.
The Divine Miss M. They taught me the show in San Francisco, and the next gig was something like Phoenix. And I looked out at the audience, and I thought, they're going to kill us. They're going to kill us. Because the mix was the most amazing thing. You had these families, the grandparents, the parents, and a couple little kids, sitting next to two drag queens in gold and silver lamé. And that is the dichotomy of what this audience was. And you would have a drag queen coming down the aisles in roller skates dressed as a bride. And you know, and you could hear a pin drop in this audience because you know they were all absolutely scared to death of each other.
Right.
And I look, this happened night after night. You know, Phoenix, Albuquerque, down. I'm going, oh, jeez. And... but she would walk out on that stage. The band would come out. Manilow was her musical director. Bette would come out with slacks, a white blouse, two white fans, 2 minutes standing ovation.
Really?
Yeah. And she'd finally have to say, shut up, sit down, I ain't done nothing yet. And they would. And by the end of the show, the end of the evening, they were dancing together. It was just, I can only imagine all the stories about Garland.
Mm-hmm. How she crossed the lines,
what she was, because I would stand there in the wings, and I'm seeing it every night in a different theater, and it's just, it was incredible to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. And one of Manilow's biggest gifts is producing a show. He is consummate, consummate artist when it comes to putting together a music show.
In what way?
He knows what works.
Ah.
He knows how to make it work musically. He knows how to line up the songs. He knows how to work the emotions.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really brilliant. Brilliant.
So he wrote it,
well,
essentially, in collaboration with her.
With her, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah. And Bruce Valanche, do you know Bruce Valanche?
I do not.
Bruce Valanche, there's a wonderful documentary you should see called Get Bruce. He was a writer in Chicago, newspaper writer in Chicago. Funny, 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 funny man. And he started writing for Bette. And he's written the Academy Awards, he's written the Emmys, he's written all these. And you hear Whoopi Goldberg and all these comedians talk about Bruce Valanche. He took Harvey Fierstein's place on Broadway in Hairspray as Edna, did it for 2 years. And anyway, Bruce and, what's his name? I can't remember, there's another guy. Well, I would be in the dressing room, and Bruce would just be there talking, and Bruce is the funniest thing in the world. Just one thing comes out of his mouth after another. And Bette's getting ready, putting on her makeup. She goes out on stage, and there's all this stuff that Bruce was doing.
She's using it.
She's using it.
Mm-hmm.
She's using it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Crazy. Then she had this hit. We wound up at the Palace on Broadway for Christmas. And she took a break. And Manilow was going out because he just had his first album, Mandy.
Mm-hmm.
And I write the songs. And he was going out and playing the clubs, the music rooms, to promote it and asked me to go with him. And I was with that for 3 years. And from leaky pipe basement music rooms all around the country, I saw us go to 17,000 seat arenas.
Wow.
And huge outdoor music festivals and Broadway again.
Wow.
Yeah. So now how old are we?
Yes. What's interesting about this is that you went, essentially, you went from virtually nothing to everything in a very short period. I mean, it was a huge leap. You sort of leapfrogged over a number of steps, kind of like what you did in school, where you shouldn't have been the stage manager for the opera or for the musical, but you sort of leapfrogged over the...
It did.
Right?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
And when I had time off, I'd be back in New York in the summer directing something off Broadway, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And... then I was trying to make the transition to Broadway, and it was difficult. And I was also being a lighting designer. Now I was being known as a lighting designer for rock and roll, which was verboten then.
Yeah.
That was a whole other thing. Broadway didn't want
to know from that. They
didn't get it. And my oldest best friend, I told you about it during the wedding, he was production manager for opera companies. So when I came off the road, bearing, I guess, he said, come to the Providence Opera and do Light This Opera. And I said, Scotty, I don't know the first thing about lighting opera. He said, yes, you do. It's a long, slow musical. I said, oh, okay, I can do that. So I learned how to light opera, and I was lighting opera all over the country. And then...
Is that an entree into Broadway when rock and roll is... No, that isn't either.
It's its own separate beast. And I had started in 76 coming back to Florida because I had gotten... New York was trying to pigeonhole me.
Well,
are you a director? Are you a lighting designer? What are you?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I can do
yes.
it all. Yes. Yes to all of that.
Yes.
And they couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
And my family was... I'm from Clearwater. I'm like fourth generation Floridian.
Ah, I didn't realize that.
So my family's down here getting older. I started coming back more to help them. And between 76 and 80, it would be a month in Florida, 2 months in New York, 2 months in Florida, 1 month in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working down here.
Oh.
And people were happy to have me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't being pigeonholed.
Mm-hmm.
So
and they were glad that you had all these skills.
Yeah. And by 80, I had moved pretty much back. And there was a huge in Tampa Bay professional theater scene. Excuse me. Dinner theater. But if you want to work in Florida,
mm-hmm.
that's what you did. So I worked constantly. And then I was, because of the lighting, I was getting regional theaters. Coconut Grove Playhouse in Miami. Burt Reynolds Theater when he
mm-hmm.
had it.
Yeah.
Syracuse Stage. And I met a director who liked my work. And he was been working on a project called Jerry's Girls, which is the music of Jerry Herman.
Mm.
And they had been working it, and he asked me to come light, to meet Jerry Herman and Key West, and then, depending upon how that went, to light the national tour.
Right.
With Carol Channing, Leslie Uggams, and Andre McArdle.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so I got the gig, I did it. It was supposed to go to Broadway, but Miss Channing could not stand this director, and she refused to go as long as he was directing the show. Well, she didn't own the show. He did.
He did. I was just going to say, right.
Anyway, that's sort of a long story, but I did that, and I got Disney on Ice. I did a Disney on Ice show. I did a Big Ice show at Busch Gardens that ran for 5 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I wound up doing less and less of the road because I'd done it for like 5 years.
Yeah,
you
really?
Know, one-nighters, you know, 5 years. And going out and doing the opera, it would be 10 days, but 10 very lonely days because my schedule was very different from their schedule, and it started off really easy for me, and then towards the end it got really, really intense and difficult. So I didn't have time to socialize very much.
Yeah,
I spent a lot of time in a hotel, and I didn't like that so much. I didn't like that so much. So I've done less, much, much less of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I was working more down here.
Yeah, and there is work here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Oh,
okay.
I love this town. I love this town, Sarasota.
Yeah.
Great
well,
town.
It is.
Shh. Don't tell
me. I know.
I
know I'm the same. So, tell me a little bit about Dear World. It is a show I don't know.
Dear World is a Jerry Herman show.
Uh-huh.
And it's based on the Jean Giraudoux's
yes.
play, The Mad Woman of Chaillot.
Yes, yes.
Which was
written. Oh, Angela. Didn't she do it?
She did on Broadway. Yeah. The original play was written in 1952.
The original,
the French play.
Yeah, right.
The Giraudoux play.
Right.
And a big hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done on Broadway and all of that. And Dear World, it was a pet show of Jerry Herman's. Lawrence and Lee, who wrote the book to Mame, mm-hmm. they had gotten the rights to Auntie Mame. And they came to Jerry and said, we have the rights to Auntie Mame. We want to turn it into a musical. Would you do the music? So that's how that collaboration happened.
Right.
And a very successful collaboration.
No kidding.
And
a brilliant score.
Jerry, yeah. Oy. And Jerry had a pet project of his, mm-hmm. The Mad Woman of Chaillot, that he wanted to turn into a chamber musical. And they went in together on it, and that's how it was developed. And it was meant to be a chamber musical. And Alexander Cohen is the director, is the producer of it, mm-hmm. which might not have been
the best choice.
The best choice. And he wanted a big Broadway blockbuster.
I was just going to say, he's not
and
known
he tried,
for his chamber music musicals.
No, he right. wanted a big Broadway blockbuster.
Right.
So they tried to blow it up. And I saw it in Boston, mm-hmm. when I was a student in Boston. That's one of the cool things about being a student in Boston.
Before they threw you out.
Yeah, before we threw me in. I mean, I saw the very first public performance of Cabaret.
Wow.
I saw the very first preview of A Little Night Music.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, all these things I got to see.
Well, we're beginning to get that here now.
Yeah, we are.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we are. So anyway, Angela, from what I have been told by somebody who knows, freaked out because she had been this glamorous Mame for
yeah.
2 years.
Right.
And then they put her in this frumpy costume with dreadful makeup and as this old mad woman.
Right.
And she was worried about her career going down the tubes
right.
and her image. And anyway, at one point, she kicked Lawrence and Lee out of the theater, and they were not allowed to come into the theater to even work on the show.
Because?
She was freaking out. And
but, I mean, what did she, they have the lyricists, for God's sakes. What did they have to do with anything?
I have no clue.
Right.
But there was they didn't speak to each other for 15 years after that. And the thing ran 130-something performances. She got a Tony.
Yeah.
And then it languished. I understand.
But it didn't hurt her career.
No. It didn't right. hurt her career. And beautiful music. Gorgeous. It's one of his best scores.
I don't know it at all, and I am so looking forward to it.
Oh, I have a CD.
CD.
Yeah,
great.
I got it. Yeah.
Terrific.
Where was I? Let me think. There was evidently a little revival somewhere, like an off-Broadway thing in the 90s, I heard, with Shirley Booth, which was supposedly okay. Anyway, in 2000, Goodspeed Opera did it. And Jerry went in, and they wanted to bring it back to be what it was supposed to be. And Jerry went in with, gosh, I don't have it with me, I'm embarrassed. His name's David. He wrote the book to Scottsboro Boys, and he wrote the book to Steel Pier. They went in and worked together at the Goodspeed production and brought it back down. Then again in 06, Sundance has a theater.
Oh, I didn't
at Sundance, yeah. Sundance did it with Maureen McGovern. And Jerry and David went in and worked it more and refined it more. And that's
the play you're doing.
The script that we're doing. Wow. You should go on YouTube. Maureen McGovern sings, what's the song? It was cut from the original, A Sensible Woman. It's very cool. There's a couple songs that we do that were not in the original.
Are you going to do them?
Oh, yeah, they're in it. Oh, yeah, they're in it. They were restored.
Ah!
They were restored.
Great.
Cast of 13.
Wow.
No chorus. Mm-hmm. It's all principals. They all carry the show. They all have to sing and sing well. Yeah. And I got a great cast.
Yes, that's great. Is he still alive, Jerry?
Oh, yeah. He's very feeble.
He's not coming.
Oh, no. Mm. No, I think Jerry's in L.A. now, but he's very feeble.
Mm. Well, he certainly gave us a lot of terrific music.
Yes, he certainly has. He certainly has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So the show opens?
January 12th. And it's running for 2 weeks with a possible extension for a third week through the 28th of January.
What day is the 12th? What day of the week?
That's a Thursday.
Okay, great. So is there a preview on the 11th? Is that, or do you have preview?
Yeah, we do previews. We do Tuesday and Wednesday, we have previews.
Okay, and then opening on Thursday the 12th.
The 12th.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I always ask as the sort of final question, when someone has given a life, as you actually have, I mean, pretty much your entire life, as much as you have had control over, you have dedicated to the theater in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult path to choose in the world that we live in. So do you have anything that you would want to say about what it was like so far to have dedicated an entire life to various aspects of the theater?
I've always felt that I was blessed. I was very lucky. I was given the talents to create magic. And it comes back to me in the most surprising ways that somebody will come up to me and say, "You touched me."
Mm-hmm.
30 years ago. And you influenced my decisions on many things 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And I have a young lady I work with now who is incredibly talented. And her mama had to remind me that I had directed her when she was 12 years old in a performing arts group in St. Pete.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't regret anything. I sometimes regret I didn't stay in New York, but you can't regret. I came to Florida. And
it's given you a very nice life.
It's given me a very nice life. Money isn't everything. Mm-hmm. I have wonderful friends. And I'm respected by my peers,
right,
which is the greatest gift.
Yes.
It doesn't matter how many awards you're nominated for or win. It's to have the respect of your peers.
Yes.
So I can't regret anything.
No, it's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Money isn't everything, and I don't regret a thing. What a wonderful thing to be able to say about your life. I believe that I was lucky. I was blessed. I was given something that I can give away that gives back to me. Wow. Would that we all could say that about our lives. And, of course, you know that I believe that we can all say that about our lives if we are fortunate enough to have been able to do what Michael did. I don't know how much of this you remember from the interview, but Michael's father was a high school track teacher. Definitely no theater in his family. No artistic bent. However, Michael's father made a point to tell him of his attachment to something he saw when he was quite young. To say over and over again, "Boy, you talked about that for weeks." And then there's his experience at 7 years old. He still remembers the baseballs on the curtain. He knew so young that art, theater, New York, drama, stories, these were the things that drew him. And so although he agreed to learn golf, although he let his dad give him a pole vault, right? He endured it all, but underneath, he held tight to his certainty of who he is, and he used every opportunity. He studied it in school. He pursued it in college. Never mind that his college was cut short. Never mind all of the obstacles that seemed to stand in his way, he stayed true to Michael. And that, of course, is the message of the Lynn Show, the theme of the Lynn Show, the point of the Lynn Show, what I am trying to get you to see, to recognize, to be aware of, that there's someone in there who you may not be aware of, in touch with, and therefore able to honor. But when you can do that, then you can say, as Michael has said, I have no regrets. I am aware of what is important. And it isn't money. And it isn't even fame. For Michael, it is the respect of his peers and the fact that he knows that he does magic and that he touches other human beings. And that he can do that with a skill which essentially he came in with. So, I hope that Michael's story has motivated you to look inside and see if maybe there's somebody in there that you have been denying, that you can say hello to and begin the process of exploring, accessing, and therefore enjoying. And also, I hope that you are planning to come out and see Dear World playing at the Players, as we said, starting on January 12th. And to whet your appetite for that, I'm going to play the version of A Sensible Woman by Maureen McGovern, which is right out of the play. So here, Maureen McGovern doing A Sensible Woman from Dear World.
A sensible woman will walk through the sewers to keep her hat out of the rain. A sensible woman will not bother her poor head at night with thoughts of thieves that prowl about. She wears her pearls to bed at night. A sensible woman grows spirited flowers by watering them with champagne. And even though life may seem distraught with inhumanity, reason and rhyme and sanity gone. With her head on her shoulder, her hand on her hat pin, a sensible woman goes on. A sensible woman creates her own fashions, believing that hats should be hats. She writes herself letters filled with witty past and present news. That way she's sure tomorrow that the news she gets is pleasant news. A sensible woman, when faced with a problem, confers with her sensible cats. And even when face to face with all the world's banality, its individuality gone. With her eye on its target, her fairest all brandished, a sensible woman goes on.
Waiter! Waiter, ask this woman to move on.
You said you wanted to see the proprietor.
She's the proprietor.
She's the madwoman of Shio.
She's mad.
Who says she's mad?
You just said so yourself.
What's mad about her?
Good God, what does it take to get a glass of water?
Water? Oh, no. Champagne.
Oh, now that's sensible.
Of course. A sensible woman will trade with a grocer some gossip for onions and rice. And then when her birthday comes, she'll simply say away with it. She'll add another beauty spot. She'll choose an age and stay with it. A sensible woman sets traps for the landlord and plays with the neighborhood mice. And if there's a moment when the night seems dark and endless and her life seems pale and friendless and alone, a grasp of her senses, a grip on her handbag, with wisdom and wit and love, with courage and cat food, with grit and goloshes, a sensible woman goes on and on.
Don't you love it? A sensible woman defies all convention. And in a way, that's also the theme of this show. That it's not what other people say you should be. It's who you are that is important. So, yes, we all have to conform to some extent. We can't all be the mad woman and do whatever seems sensible to us at the moment. But we can all do more of who we really are and less of what the conventions say we must be, what our parents thought was right, what our teachers said we had to believe, what our friends approve of. There's somebody inside there who is much more sensible because it is much more us. And I urge you to look for that person. And you know I cannot remember, so if I didn't already say, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, don't leave the E out of Lynn, in thelynnshow.com. And if you want to talk about this, you can email me. There's a link to email me, and I'll be happy to talk to you about it. You can listen to not only this interview on my website, but all the interviews that I have ever done. Many, many of them quite remarkable, which is to say the people that I interviewed are quite remarkable. And virtually all of them are telling the same story, which is I honored myself, and that made all the difference. So I am hoping, as always, that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that turned you on, something you didn't know that you now know, something that you knew but had forgotten, something that made you think or laugh or smile, or something that'll bring you back, because I will be here. Oh, don't let me forget the most important thing, which is to thank the indomitable Josh Hackney, who saves me whenever I get into trouble, who created the computer that I'm using, who found the software that I'm using, who taught me to use it, who continues to teach me to use it whenever I forget. Everyone needs Josh. And again, if you go up on my website, you can find him by emailing me and saying, I want Josh, and I will get him for you. So as I had started to say, I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I always hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten